Vegas Bad Boy of Podcasting is an entertainment-based program. The opinions shared are that of the host and their guests. Some celebrity voices are impersonated and usually not well. This program is not intended for kids and certain adults. Listener's discretion is advised. You have been warned. Now let's get ready to podcast. This is a special edition with our guest, Marty Elias. Welcome to another edition of Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting. I have two bad boys here with me, Sin City Steve.
Well.
Okay. Matt Michaels.
Well.
Why not? Man, look, we got an awesome guest on the line here. Now, he was the referee for both WWE and Lucha Underground, and he refereed one of the best matches that I was there for, because I've been to lots of WrestleManias. And it was Shawn Michaels Undertaker match. Come on, one of the best matches. I'm talking about Marty Elias, everyone. Welcome, Marty. How are you?
I'm doing great, guys. Thank you for having me on. You know, I really appreciate that. And you know what? Let me just clarify as far as the Taker-Shawn match.
Okay.
That is considered the greatest match in WrestleMania history. So There you go.
Boom. Woo!
Yeah. And let's clarify that, okay, guys?
No, I hear you. Well, I was on my feet, so it's true.
And if Jimmy Corderas would have refereed it, it wouldn't have been the best ever. It would have been a so-so match.
Right.
Well, I will say this. Charles Robinson originally had that match.
Really? Really? Yeah. What happened to little Nate? Did you tie him up in the back? Or?
No. Oddly enough, you know, Sean and I are friends, and we had conversations because, you know, whenever you get into anything, profession, entertainment, life, or whatever, you always got to have goals for yourself. And for me, when I got into entertainment and I got into whatever, I always have goals, and I like to achieve those goals, you know, no matter what. If you don't have any goals, you know, you might as well just, you know, bury yourself and, you know, just, you know, don't exist. So I had set a goal for myself when I first got into the business that I wanted to work with Shawn Michaels, whether it was the Rockers or whether it was, you know, HBK or whatever, you know, because I always followed his career, and he was my guy and still is my guy to this day. And he and I became friends when I was at WWE and such. And, you know, I had told him, I said, my goal in wrestling in my career is to work with you at WrestleMania. I said, because you are the icon, you're Mr. WrestleMania, you're the showstopper. I said, so I want that. I said, and if we can make it happen, I said, you know, your career is coming to an end. I said, you know, I don't know how many more WrestleManias you have in with you. I said, but that's one of my goals. And we were on a flight from Arizona to Seattle, and he goes, let's try and work on that. So we left it at that and really didn't even have any more conversations about it until, you know, WrestleMania was upon us. And referees always get the assignments around 3 weeks prior to those events. And we had a referee meeting, and Charles Robinson's name was attached to it. And I was, all right, cool. You know, I mean, oddly enough, I had the dark match with the Colognes versus Miz and Morrison at that time. Wow. And I was like, well, I guess I'm not going to be on the actual event. So, man. You know, but hey, it was WrestleMania, the whole vibe. So I was just happy to be there. Yeah. So we were actually in San Antonio, Texas, of all places. And I went to Sean and I said, hey, bud, I don't have your match at Mania. I said, you know, maybe next year. And he goes, you don't? And I said, no. And that was the conversation. It wasn't, I went whining to him and crying to him, and, oh, Sean, I don't have, you know, because people do that in wrestling. I said, I don't have your match, you know, and, you know, maybe next year. And left it at that. So the next day, we were in Corpus Christi, Texas. Remember when Sean did the whole white thing, and he came out, and the ring was, you know, full of smoke and stuff, and then Caleb came out from the ring, and well, that show was in Corpus Christi, Texas, and before the show, I went into the locker room, sat down. Sean and I always sat down next to each other, and he says, "Have a seat." I went, "All right, cool." So I sat down, and he says, "Hey, you got my match." I got your match. He goes, "You know," and I'm thinking, tonight, you know, we're doing SmackDown. You know, I'm like, "Oh, okay, cool." And he and I go, "Okay, great." And he goes, "You got Mania." And I went, "Oh, okay." And I was like, "Wow, you know, did he really say that?" So, you know, we just left everything the way it was. And, you know, we get to WrestleMania, and, you know, lo and behold, I had the match, and, you know, the rest is history.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Amazing. Yeah. Especially, yeah. You know, bringing up WrestleMania, and this is something I've really never thought about until you were talking about, you know, getting the chance to wrestle or referee a match at WrestleMania. Does it work for you guys the same as it works for the wrestlers, where if you're on the card, you get a higher percentage? How does that work for referees in terms of their contracts?
Well, WWE back then always went off of the houses, and okay. What I mean by that was attendance.
Yeah,
you know, and it was funny because, you know, if you were the referee for a live event or a show or whatever, if you were the first referee out there, you know, it was your responsibility to go out and gauge the crowd. You know, and it was funny, like, you would come back from your from that match, and you would have the boys going, "How's the house? How's the house?" You know. And you would gauge the house, and you would tell people, and go, okay, cool, it's gonna be a good one. So, you know, everything was based off of that. And, you know, I mean, 75,000 people, I mean, you know, paying whatever they paid, and, you know, it's split amongst everybody. I mean, yeah. You know, so,
that's pretty sweet.
It was pretty sweet. But from what I've been told, that it's a lot different today, you know, because there's the network and stuff. And, you know, apparently, you know, the payoffs aren't there anymore, and, you know, but that's just a rumor. But I wouldn't want to be there for that, you know, because with all the pay-per-views that are done and stuff, it's like, right. Ah.
An interesting, I didn't even think about how the network itself affects the quote-unquote pay-per-view revenue when it's not.
And the buy rates. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's crazy, considering it it was always the buy rates, you know.
Yes, it was. It was. And it was always the house, you know, and you always got a percentage off of that, and that's the way WWE always worked it, you know, when I was there. So
how grueling is the travel on a referee?
It's just as grueling as it is for one of the boys, you know. Yeah. I mean, you do that schedule too, and that schedule can get grueling. I remember, I believe it was 2007. I did 310 days on the road that year.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's grueling. So, you know, you got to figure, you got the States, you got Japan, you got Australia, you got Europe, you got, you know, Mexico. I mean, you got everything. So, yeah. So I was, you know, doing some traveling.
Definitely. It sounds like it. Now, obviously, you shared with us the story about how the referee assignment was changed leading up to WrestleMania. Have you ever been a part of anything where maybe an angle or a finish has changed, maybe the day of the event or leading up to that?
Extreme Rules. When Tommy Dreamer had that three-way with, I believe Christian was the ECW champion.
Mm-hmm.
What was that? Extreme Rules in New Orleans.
Okay. Yeah.
It was Christian, Swagger, and Tommy Dreamer. So we went through the match and everything, and the finish was Swagger over on Dreamer.
Mm, okay.
And, you know, so this is when Tommy was renegotiating his deal and stuff, and it was his last day and everything else. So we had had a match planned out and stuff, and we had a finish. And when match, you know, was happening, as Christian came in, you know, he goes, Tommy's up. And I went, okay. So then Swagger came out, and Swagger goes, Tommy's up on me with his finish. And I went, okay, cool. And so I was like, all right, cool. So then Dreamer comes out, and as Tommy's getting through the ropes and stuff, and I said, you're up on Swag? He goes, yeah, let's hurry up and do this before they change your mind. And, awesome. You know, lo and behold, Tommy Dreamer won his first ECW championship ever. I mean, he had won an ECW, but they took it away the next day.
Right.
But
right.
This was the first time that he had actually won the title, the ECW championship, and he was Tommy Dreamer, the ECW champion, finally, you know? So that was fun.
Finally. That's awesome. Great story.
Yeah.
So
I was there for that.
Is there anything that sticks out in your mind to, you know, there's been a lot of focus on referees recently with, you know, guys either dying in the ring or, being the ones who have to, you know, kind of make that decision if this is something we need to call, you know, help on. Or is there ever been a situation that you were in terms of there being some kind of like brutal injury or anything that you had to go and just immediately throw up the X or, you know, get help? Did you save anyone's lives or help anyone, you know?
Well, as a referee, it's our responsibility to make sure that everybody's safe and everybody, you know, is, you know, getting their time cues and such. Again, I don't know how this happened, but this just happened with me and being at the right time and the right, you know, spot or right match or whatever. Or it's just I'm that fucking good and I was assigning these matches. So let's just say that. I was in the ring when Triple H tore his left quad. At New Year's Revolution against Rated RKO. It was DX versus Rated RKO in Kansas City at New Year's Revolution when Hunter, you know, messed up his quad. You know, so I was in the ring for that. And we had a finish, and when he, you know, tore his quad, he knew it right away. And I knew something was wrong because he went to give Randy that spine buster, and when he did it, I heard it.
Yeah.
And he heard it, and when he was down selling, I said, are you okay? I said, H, are you good? Are you good? And all he kept saying is, I'm fucked, I'm fucked, I'm fucked.
Oh,
and,
man.
And in my ear, it was Jerry Briscoe saying, you know, is Hunter okay? Check on Hunter, get him out of there. So I was relaying this message. I was saying, you know, powder out, powder out, powder out. And, of course, when you're Triple H and you are the game, the match goes on.
Right.
And, you know, he's going to finish the match. And, you know, hats off to him because, you know, that's passion and that's, you know, the type of guy that he is, you know, that injuries don't mean shit. I mean, you know, when you're at that level, of course, you know, you got to give the fans what they want and stuff. And, you know, don't be a pussy. I mean, really. So, you know. We, you know, it was an audible, and I had to tell Edge and Randy, and I had to tell Sean, you know, that he was legitimately hurt and stuff. And, of course, I was thrown at the X and all that. And then Sean just, you know, goes, we're going to a schmoz. And That's what we did. You know, it was right there on the fly, and Sean started doing stuff. Randy got the chair and stuff, came in. Sean bit me, and I powdered out and stuff, and it was no contest. You know, the match was thrown out, and that's just – when you're in the ring with guys like that who can think on their toes and just, you know, in an instant change everything, I mean, you know, that's when you know that you're at that level.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're dealing with guys like Shawn Michaels, Triple H, Edge, and Randy Orton, and something goes, you know, wrong, and you're in that match and you're in that situation, when you're able to adjust and make it happen, then, you know, you're pretty fucking good at what you do.
Definitely, yeah, man.
Most definitely.
And that's why you're one of the best around. I mean, there's no doubt about
no,
it.
No, I'm the best around. Sorry, guys. And you know what? And you know what? That's not ego. That's not anything. Look at my fucking work.
Yeah,
look at
facts.
What I've done. You know, I take it as seriously as the next guy and stuff. And, you know, for me, I like to say that I'm the Shawn Michaels of referees. I'm that fucking good. And like I said, it's not an ego thing. It has nothing to do with being conceited. I just know that I was given a gift by the man upstairs to do professional wrestling, and I do it at the very top level. I mean, it's just I was been given a gift, and I know what my gift is, and it was being a pro wrestling referee and being the fucking greatest. And that's what it is.
So when you're around all the boys and you have all the travel, do the boys include the referees on some of the ribs? And if so, have you been ribbed or have you played a rib that sticks out?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you're knee deep in the ribs and stuff and everything. And, you know, I will tell you guys a story of a great rib that happened to me that I don't think many people know about. But it was great. And to be ribbed like this, I mean, ribbing doesn't happen today,
right,
you know, and it's sad because guys don't rib anymore. And ribbing was part of, you know, what we did. It's part of the history of being one of the boys.
Yep.
So we were in Europe, and it was my first trip overseas with WWE. And I knew Cena from UPW and stuff because I was the booker at UPW back in the day for Rick Bassman. You know, I was there when Cena got signed. I was there when, you know, all these other people got signed. Lisa Marie Victoria got signed out of there. So I was the guy booking all that stuff in California for Rick Bassman. So I knew Cena for a long time. And we were in Europe, and I wanted to prove myself and show that I could hang with the boys. So we were down drinking. It was me, Timmy White, Umaga, you know, God rest his soul, Cena, and Carlito. And everybody was coming in, and we were sitting in the middle of a Hilton, and we were in the lobby. Just, I mean, we had everything that we wanted, and we were having a good time after a show. So everybody started powdering out and going to their rooms and stuff. So Cena was like, what is this? Everybody's, you know, leaving. He's like, no. He's like, you know, I'm the champ. Everybody should be drinking with me. So Cena says, hey, you know, do me a favor. Go get everybody and get them down here to drink. You know, everybody's, you know, leaving. So I went to the general manager at the front desk. And thank God he was a huge wrestling fan. So he gave me a key. A skull key, which opened up everything, and I promised him tickets and stuff for the show the next day. So, you know, he was happy. So he gave me a skull key, which I could open any door in that hotel. So I started going up to everybody's rooms, and I started opening doors and saying, the champ wants you downstairs. Get your ass down, and let's drink and stuff. And people are half asleep, getting out of bed naked, and just like, what's going on? Turning on the lights. So did that. So I came downstairs, and Cena's like, where's Lance Cade and Trevor Murdoch? And I said, they're still up there. He's like, well, go get those two guys. So, all right. So I went to Trevor first, and then Trevor threatened me. He's like, I'm going to kick your Mexican ass and get out of here. So, all right, cool. So then I go to Lance Cade's room, and I barge in, and Lance goes like, well, what the fuck are you doing? Get out of my room and stuff. So I said, the champ wants you downstairs right now. If you're not down there, he's like, you know what? If Cena wants me down, tell him to fucking come get me himself. I'm like, okay. So I go downstairs and I tell Cena that. And Cena goes, what room is he in? And I said, well, he's up here. So, okay, let's go. So me and Cena go up in the elevator, and we get up and we go to Lance's room, and I try to open the door. Nothing happens. So he had it locked and jimmied and stuff. And then Cena's like, let's knock. So we're knocking, knocking, knocking. And mind you, this is 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. And we're like beating the shit out of the door. And people start coming out of their rooms and going like, what's going on? I mean, because we were getting very loud. And so finally, I'm knocking. I'm going, come on, Lance, open the door. I said, man, I said, if you don't open it, Cena's going to kick my ass, bro. Come on. But when I was doing that, Cena crouched down like in a stalking position. So Lance goes, if I open the door and you're there, I'm going to kill you. So I go, come on, come on, please, please, please. So Lance finally opened the door. Cena pushes me and bum rushes Lance Cade, and he starts and they start, you know, scrapping right there, you know, like wrestling on the beds and shit. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you know, you got these two big guys who were just like going at it, and they broke the bed. That was the first one that went. They broke the bed, and then Lance's going, everything. They're kicking lamps and shit and everything, and, you know, stuff's getting looking in the room. And I'm just standing in the doorway going, like, holy shit. And so Lance Cade, Cena grabs him and cinches him up, and Lance goes, when I get out of this, he goes, I'm going to fucking kill you. And I went, exit, stage left, and I was out. So the next day, we go to the arena, and I'm, you know, sitting there, and when I go into the locker room, everybody gets up and they leave. And I went, oh, all right. So then Hunter comes in, and Hunter goes, who'd you piss off? I went, I don't know. He goes, man, you piss somebody off. And I went, no, I don't know. So I went, did the show, everything else. So we go back to the hotel, and I'm up at the front desk, and Flair's there. And he goes, hey, you going to the bar? And I go, yeah, absolutely. So I went into catering, and I sit down to eat, and the boys that were there at the table, they get up and they leave. So I go, okay, something's up. So I went, all right, something's going down. So I went up to my room. I took everything out of my pockets and stuff. And I said, if something's going to go down, I'm going to be ready for it. So I put on some sweatpants and a T-shirt, and I go downstairs. And as soon as the elevator gets to the lobby, doors open, and here comes Shelton Benjamin, Trevor Murdoch, Lance Cade, Mike Chioda. And they just bum rush me, and they just start pinning me down. And all of a sudden, I feel my socks and shoes come off.
No, sure.
I feel my shirt come off. I feel my pants come off. I feel my underwear come off.
So
Shelton Benjamin is sitting on me, and all of a sudden, I feel my hands get tied together. And what they did is they used zip ties, and they zip tied my hands together, and they zip tied my ankles together.
Oh,
and I'm butt-ass naked in an elevator in Manchester, England.
Wow.
So they do this, and Roddy Piper, God bless him, and I miss that guy. I mean, he was so great. So Piper comes in and joins in. Because him and Flair were tag team champions at that time, working with Spirit Squad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, and so Piper comes in, he starts getting in it and everything, and Piper looks at me and he goes, oh, my God, kid. He goes, if I had a small dick like that, I'd fucking kill myself. It was cold, okay? We're in England. It was snowing. Come on. Give me a break.
Right. Come on.
You know? So,
it's England.
So then the boys proceed to drag me out of the hotel. And Randy Orton gets the bright idea of getting a luggage cart.
They get a luggage cart,
oh, and Randy Orton and Mike Chioda get me, and they put me on the luggage cart. So Randy, being Randy, mm-hmm. starts wheeling me around the lobby and shit. There's fans, there's guests, everything else, and I'm naked on this hogtied, and Randy's pushing me around the lobby and taking me into catering and stuff and everything on this luggage cart, butt-ass naked. So Randy gets the bright idea. He's like, I'm going to take him outside. And mind you, it's snowing in Manchester, England this time. So I go on the cart, and Flair's still at the front desk. And he's like, woo, baby, let's get naked. Woo, woo.
Oh, no.
So as I go by, the door is open, and Randy has a bright idea. He takes me out. And mind you, this Hilton in Manchester, it had a slope on the right side of the driveway. So Randy had the bright idea. He goes, fuck it, let's push him. So he gets, and he pushes me down this slope, and all of a sudden I'm in this luggage cart, and it's going down this slope. So it finally hits a rock, and it falls over, and I fall ass naked into the snow. And Randy and everybody's laughing and stuff. You know, it was probably about 50 yards, and they're laughing and stuff, and they go back in the hotel. So I had to jimmy myself up, and I literally started bunny hopping back to the hotel, butt-ass naked, going up the driveway, and I start bunny hopping, you know, and my Johnson's flinging back in the air, too, and everything, because, you know, I had to hop naked.
Right.
So I get back into the hotel and stuff, and they tackle me, and then they start, you know, getting me drinks and stuff and everything. And then they get me and they toss me into the elevator. and they throw all my clothes in there and shit, and then they push every single button, every floor, and they close the door. So I start going up, and I'm like on the ground lying down hogtied. So I start going up the floors and shit, and the door's open, and there's guests and people going like, oh my God, people are freaking the fuck out because there's a naked guy in a hotel elevator. I mean, it was a Hilton. So, you know, the last thing they expect to see is a naked Mexican from the U.S. You know? So I finally was able to crawl out, and I luckily I had my room key stashed, and I went. I opened up my room. I couldn't find any scissors and everything. I had literally had to gnaw myself out of the hand ties and stuff, you know, like a little rabid bear or something, you know, and I had to bite myself out. I got dressed, went downstairs, went to the bar, had a great time, and, you know, got drunk, had fun. It was great. The boys laughed. They enjoyed it. Next day we get on the bus, and Triple H goes, he goes, did you guys read the paper today? And what? He goes, yeah, something about some naked dude in a hotel. And I'm going like, don't know. So I'm sitting there, and Sean comes up to me, and he goes, this was fun. And I go, what? He goes, nothing but good ribbon. He goes, this was so much fun. And he goes, Sean goes, you did exactly what you needed to do, kid. Good job. And I went, I didn't put it over. I didn't, you know, I was like, all right, you know, so, and Sean goes, that's what's missing today. Good ribbon. And, you know, come to find out that Lance and Trevor went to Hunter and they told him, hey, we got to get Marty back for what he did. So it was Hunter's idea to hog tie me. So there you go.
Sounds like an oh shit moment.
Yeah. Oh man.
But you know what's great? Remember the WWE magazine? Remember when they had in the very back when they had, you know, you should have been there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They actually had that in the WWE magazine. They didn't name me, but Trevor Murdoch and those guys, you know, they said, you know, that they had done this to a referee and stuff, and you know, there you went. So it was fun.
Oh, that's remarkable. I love that it all started because of John and wanting to drink longer, because that is definitely John.
Yeah. So, you know, and you know, when you're on the road, you know, the camaraderie and the companionship and, you know, I mean, we're out there, you know, we're in the trenches together. So, of course, we're going to do stuff, you know, to entertain ourselves and have fun. And, you know, instead of going out and doing stupid shit to, you know, to destroy things and stuff like that, we just had good fun. And that's what, you know, when I got into the business and the ribs and stuff like that, you know, that's exactly what it's about. I mean, you know, you have fun like that with your peers and your boys and stuff. And, you know, these are memories and stuff, you know, that of course I can share stories like this because I got a million of them. And it's like, you know, when I look back, when I'm on my deathbed, when I'm 100 years old, I'm not going to be that guy saying, man, I should have, could have, would have, you know, I'm, you know, man, it was a good run. Thank you.
And the cool thing too is that somewhere at the same time, a woman who is 100 years old is dying and going in her last breath, remember that time we were staying at the Hilton in Manchester, England, and we saw a naked man? that's great. So, you know, we're talking about the wrestling road. Let's talk a little bit about the rock and roll road. What's the difference what's the difference between life on the road with someone like a Vince Neil or a group like Slaughter as compared to the WWE or the, you know, the wrestlers? Is there much of a difference, or is the lifestyle kind of similar?
They have a lot of similarities, but they actually have different vibes to them. And what I mean by that is, you know, a wrestling crowd versus a music crowd is completely different. And what I mean by that is, you know, that people are there to have a good time, sing the songs, whereas wrestling fans and stuff, they're there to get their aggression out, scream and shout, yell at a heel, curse, drink beer. I mean, they do that at rock shows too, but it's just a different vibe. It's still an entertainment thing, but it's a different vibe, and it's not so... Well, I mean, when I was on the road with WWE, and I mean, it was nonstop. It was crazy. But when you're doing these Vince Neil shows, you're doing the Slaughter shows, and I was actually out on the Mayhem festivals. Nice. I toured with Rob Zombie, Five Finger Death Punch, and then Sevenfold and Korn. So I was with those guys too, back in 2013, 2014. So, I mean, I did a lot of touring with rock bands. So there is a difference, but at the same time, you know, they do have different aspects about them. What I mean by that is that rock and roll tours go for 4 months, whereas the wrestling tours, I mean, that's, you know, 365.
Yeah.
Nonstop. So I think, if anything, I think just the schedules are different, because rock bands and, you know, you're able to do summer tours, and you do a summer tour, let's say you do July through November, October, and then you're done. And then you do the one-off shows and stuff like that, you know, that you go do. But with wrestling, I mean, it's nonstop, you know. So I think that's the major difference with me. Everything else, I mean, as far as having fun and getting stupid and, you know, enjoying yourself, you know, I mean, that's what you do. And oddly enough, when I was out on these rock and rolls tour, even today, I don't drink or do anything stupid like that anymore. So for me, I mean, it's all sober now, and I get to see things differently and go like, holy shit, did I do that? <You know? laughs> Yeah.
What would you say is the difference between a groupie at a rock show or a ring rat at a wrestling show?
Absolutely nothing. They're there to do the same thing. They just have different names. That's all it is.
And what, I mean, you're passionate about music. What got you into, you know, doing, you play bass and guitar? Is it something that you started as a kid? Did you realize you had some kind of talent, or is it something that you actually taught yourself a little later in life?
I taught myself a little later in life. Of course, growing up, I was dirt poor. My dad was in prison for 12 years. It was my mom and seven kids on welfare and food stamps. So, you know, we didn't have a pot to piss in. So I remember, you know, seeing Kiss and hearing about Kiss and going like, oh, my God, this is something different. This is, you know, this is something that I could really enjoy and get into. So I always wanted to be in Kiss, but that wasn't going to happen because I couldn't afford the equipment. I was poor. I just, you know, all of the above. But I do remember vividly when I was 10 years old hearing that Kiss played Madison Square Garden, and they sold it out four nights in a row in 1977 on the Love Gun tour.
Yeah.
And I remember telling my mother that one day that I was going to go to Madison Square Garden where Kiss played, and I was going to perform there. And mind you, I'm 10 years old, you know, dirt poor, welfare and food stamps, don't know, you know, where our next meal's coming from, don't know if we're going to get evicted or whatever. And my dad's in prison, so it was my mom on her own. So, I mean, talk about struggling. It was a fucking struggle. But it made me who I am today. But I remember telling my mother that I was going to go to New York and perform at Madison Square Garden. And mind you, at this time, New York, Madison Square Garden to me was a fucking lifetime away. I mean, it was another world to me.
Yeah.
And my mom didn't know anything about traveling. My mom, the first time my mom ever traveled was when I flew her out to WrestleMania in Detroit in 2007. That was the first time that lady had ever been in an airplane.
Wow.
You know? And for me, I get goosebumps saying that because I was able to do that for my mother and show my mother that no matter where we came from, I fucking succeeded and I made it.
Yeah.
So I remember telling her that, and she was like, oh, okay, that's nice. You know, your typical Mexican mom. Okay, that's nice. You know? And, you know, fast forward, the first time I ever did Madison Square Garden, which was unreal to me, I was finally at the Garden. I called her up from a payphone in the backstage area of Madison Square Garden, and I told her, I said, guess where I'm at? I said, watch me tonight. I'm going to be on Monday Night Raw. I said, I'm in New York. I'm in Madison Square Garden. Remember I told you when I was 10 years old that I was going to be here, and I'm doing it. And, of course, my mom being my mother, and I love her to death. She's everything to me. She goes, oh, that's nice. So my mother knows. She gets it. She knows, but it doesn't click to her because it's not her world and stuff, but she does know that her son made it and he performed at Madison Square Garden and was on TV. What was even cooler about it is the first time I ever worked with Raw and SmackDown at the Garden. It was Monday Night Raw, and I got to work it with Roddy Piper. It was when he tagged with the Highlanders.
Oh, wow.
So for me, it was very special because we all know WrestleMania 1 was Piper.
Yeah.
At Madison Square Garden. And I told Piper that. I go, this is surreal to me. I said, because I remember watching WrestleMania 1 when you were here at the Garden, and here I am working the Garden for the first time, and I'm working it with you. I said, this is surreal. I said, especially as a fan and, you know, coming where I came from and stuff like that, it doesn't get any better than this. And he goes, and Piper looks at me and he goes, oh, let's go kick the shit out of the Garden, kid. And, you know, it was great. It was great, you know. And what I love about these things is nobody can take this shit away from me. No matter what it is, no matter if I never do wrestling again or whatever, I mean, nobody can ever take that away from me. And I worked my ass to do it, and I got there, and I'm still doing it.
That's brilliant. That's wonderful. Speaking of mom, being that you had a Mexican mom, what is your favorite home-cooked dish?
My favorite home-cooked dish that mom makes is chile con carne with tomatillo sauce and some flour tortillas. I mean, and some nice shells, you know. And I just, you know, it's funny because, you know, I eat completely different. But whenever I have a cheat day or I feel like, you know, I call mom and I go, Mom, I said, can you make me some chile tomatillo with carne? And she's like, yeah, come over. And I go and it's there. And, you know, but it's like I don't do it all the time. It's just, you know, when I get that itch to have mom's home cooking meal, that's right. That's my go-to.
Wow, that sounds really good. If you happen to get that like FedExed over to Vegas, we'd be
yeah, it's great.
Is there something that, you know, in between all you've been doing, is there something that stands out to you as one of the most satisfying things for, you know, all the, you know, all the accolades you've gotten, whether it be wrestling or, you know, being able to work in the music industry, which is remarkable? Is there something that stands out to you that you just go, you know, this is the heaven moment. This is like something that just this is it.
Yeah. You know, at WrestleMania 25. And it's funny because I told Chris Jericho this on, you know, his podcast, which we'll get to. Remember during WrestleMania 25 where Shawn does the skin the cat?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he comes in and he's shimmying and Taker's getting him and he sets him up and he hits the tombstone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For me, that false finish, that count,
yep,
for me at that point was everything that I had worked for. I mean, getting fucked over by promoters, not getting paid, you know, traveling, you know, doing whatever I had to do to make it and get there and prove, because, you know, as a referee, I mean, nobody expects you to make it as a referee. I mean, especially, you know, in pro wrestling, I mean, you're just considered a lowly referee. But here's the thing. I'm not a lowly referee. I'm fucking the best. So mm-hmm. that false finish for me was everything that I had worked for up until that moment, because it was the first time that Undertaker has showed emotion. Nobody expected Shawn Michaels to kick out of that. Yeah. And when I had 75,000 people counting with me, oof, and to swerve 75,000 people was the fucking pinnacle of everything in wrestling. That was the moment where it was like, got you, motherfuckers. And then from that point on, nobody knew who was going to win.
Right.
That was mm-hmm. the beauty of it. Nobody, when Shawn kicked out of that, everybody went, what the fuck? Nobody knew.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knew.
Awesome.
So wrestling wise, that was tremendous. Music wise, the pinnacle for me was that working on Vince Neil's crew and Vince Neil knowing me and my brother Mike personally, and we're a part of his crew, and for Vince Neil to fucking come up to us at shows and give us hugs and say, hey guys, how's it going? Hey Marty, hey Mike, you know, that is surreal. That's, I mean, this is Motley fucking crew you're talking about. This is Vince right. Neil. And for me, being a huge crew fan, because if it wasn't for Motley Crue, I mean, I think I never would have really you know, stuck to my gun, so to speak, and really went for it, because I was 15 years old the first time I ever hitchhiked to see Motley Crue in 1981 at a club.
Wow.
Nice.
You know?
Wow.
So, hell yeah. So to be 15 years old in 1981, to fucking go and see this new band that nobody knew about and didn't give a shit about, and rewind to today and to be part of his crew and to have him acknowledge me and my brother, and we're working for him. I mean, it doesn't get any fucking better than that. You got a rock and roll legend, icon, I mean, whose music and voice has been the soundtrack of a lot of fucking people's lives, you know? And for me to be that 15-year-old kid to hitchhike to see this guy when he was in shit, and then for him to be who he is today and be a part of his crew, you can't write that shit. You can't. And I always take a step back, and me and my brother Mike, we go like, fuck, is this really happening, dude? This is happening to us. Mm-hmm. Fucking, this is us, dude. It isn't anybody else. And to me, that is the pinnacle for me as far as, fuck yeah, I made it, you know? And nobody can take it away from me, you know? And that for me is something that I still pinch myself. I could be an egomaniac and be an asshole, and oh yeah, I work for Ben. I still pinch myself, even when I do wrestling stuff. Even the fact that I know Chris Jericho, I know Shawn Michaels, I still pinch myself. You know, I can text with Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, and hey, Rick, how's it going? That shit is surreal to me, dude.
That's amazing.
You know, that I can do that.
That's just wonderful, and I think that anyone listening, if you have that passion and you have that dream, follow those dreams, because, you know, one day you'll find yourself texting Ricky Steamboat. I mean, that's just amazing.
Absolutely.
That's amazing. And speaking of those kind of guys, you mentioned Jericho. So you had a chance to recently do his podcast. When is, when eventually will that podcast come out? And when do you think, or I'm sorry, not when, but what was it like, you know, getting a chance to sit down and talk to Chris, who you've known for a while, you know, in this form, on the podcast form?
For me, it was great, you know, because Chris and I are friends before anything else. You know, I mean, we're good friends, and I see Chris as an inspiration, and I see him as a mentor. I really do. Because Chris has been very successful in wrestling, but he's also been successful in TV and music and all the other things that he does. It's like anything that he sets his mind to, he does it. And I remember when WWE released me, I remember he was the first call that I made, and he told me, he goes, go out and do whatever the fuck you want to do.
Yeah.
He goes, don't let this, you know, put a dent in what you want to do. He goes, I know it sucks. He goes, but go out and do whatever you want to fucking do. He's like, you don't have any chains or anybody telling you yes or no. And he goes, the transition is going to be tough. It's going to be difficult. He goes, but if you stick through it and you do it, you're going to come out, you know, looking like fucking $1 million. And I went, okay, cool. Was it difficult? Absolutely. But you know, to do his podcast, he and I had been talking about doing his podcast for a year, 2 years, you know, because he was in LA or whatever, would hang out, I'd do Fozzy stuff, and we had discussed it, and it was just, you know, the timing wasn't there. It wasn't there. And, you know, when we finally decided, you know, that we were going to do it, it was like, all right, you know, we are going to do this. I'm not going to give it away because it's pretty fucking cool what we did. It was a different kind of interview.
Nice.
But it was something that people are going to go like, wow, this was cool. This was very cool. But it was great. And for me, it wasn't even, you know, that I was talking to Chris Jericho on his podcast. Mm-hmm. To me, I was talking to my boy.
Yeah.
We just happened to have microphones and recording equipment that was running, and it captured what we were talking about. And, you know, I was honest. I was open about things. And, you know, I said some things that, you know, that some people may go like, wow. But you know what? You know, I don't worry about that shit. I don't worry about having heat in wrestling. I don't worry about who likes me or doesn't like me. You don't like me? You know, go fuck yourself. I don't care. you know, because I'm who I am. I'm my individual. I'm making my own way. I'm great to everybody. I treat everybody the way that, you know, I expect to be treated. If you're an asshole to me, I'll be an asshole to you. But for the most part, and I think a lot of people can vouch for me, that I treat everybody with respect, dignity. I'm a very ethical guy, and I love everybody. But if you treat me like shit and you do me wrong, then go fuck yourself. You know?
Words to live by.
Yeah.
Amen. And you know what? Nobody's stopping me except me.
Hell yeah.
You know, just, true. Just because of the fact that I'm not working with these companies and I'm not working, I don't give a fuck. I mean, mm-hmm. I still got my music. I got my TV production that I do. I do my freelancing shit with Slaughter. I do my Vince Neil shit. So it's like, I really don't need fucking wrestling. I really don't. Mm-hmm. And it's awful to say that, but I mean, what else am I going to do to top Taker and Shawn at 25? You can't.
Yeah.
So if I go back, I would like to go back and help out behind the scenes, an agent, you know, production wise, whatever, because I really don't need to be refereeing out there, you know, being on TV. Can I still do it? Fuck yeah. Absolutely. You know, I still got 10, 15 years in me, but I don't need to go and pursue that because I have these other avenues that I've been blessed to really just move forward on. And that's what I mean. Chris told me this, you know, when I got released from WWE, and guess what? I'm doing it. Yep. You know, I don't need to sit and beg somebody for a fucking job. You know, my credentials in my career, you know, enough said. So, I mean, if you don't want to hire me or I'm not going to be a part of your company, you know, I'm not going to lose fucking sleep over it. I'm not.
Yeah, without a doubt.
You know, and I tell people that. I go, I'm never going to be a victim of professional wrestling because Lord knows there's a lot of victims out there. And I made a promise to myself that I was never going to be the 75-year-old guy at a fucking wrestling convention trying to hawk a fucking 8x10.
God knows there are enough of them.
Yeah.
That's not me. And I'm not bitter about the business. I mean, I was let go by WWE and stuff, and I'm not working for any major companies. But I'm good with that. You know, I'm good with that. I've achieved more in my life than I ever thought that I was going to do. And, you know, it's still continuing to happen. And you're either with me or you're against me. And it's funny because I like to use the analogy from the Tom Cruise movie with Cameron Diaz, you know. What was the movie called?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, but yes. You know what I'm talking about, right?
yeah. I was on Sony's lot when they had the post-production going on, and I can't remember the
yes.
name.
So Tom Cruise tells Cameron Diaz in the movie, when she ultimately finds out who he is or what he does and shit, she always tells him, you know, he tells her, he goes, with me, without me. With me, without me. And that has always stuck with me because he's like, you know, the bar is here with me. And if you're not with me, the bar is down here. So you make the fucking choice.
Yeah.
So it's like you're with me without me. If you're in the middle, fuck off.
That's awesome.
And, you know, that goes for everything. I mean, you know, you can apply that to life. You can apply that to relationships. You know, you can apply it to anything that you do. You're with me, you're not with me. And if you're not with me, then good fucking luck in your life. You know, because guess what? My life fucking rules.
Hell yeah. Now, obviously, you know, you were at the Bumps and Bruises event where we did a live pre-show. So obviously, I mean, you're still in and around the business to some extent to this day.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, I'm curious as to your views on the emergence of AEW and a lot of wrestling fans feel like as if we're on the cusp of another boom period. Do you get that vibe or what's your outlook on the current scene in professional wrestling?
To be honest with you, I really don't follow. I don't follow wrestling. Uh-huh. I really don't. Mm-hmm. I haven't followed wrestling in maybe a year, 2 years. I haven't followed wrestling. I don't have social media. I don't follow wrestling, don't need to know about wrestling, but am I still involved with it and still connected to it? I'll always be a part of it. It'll always be a part of me. Do I have the luxury that I can get on the phone and call somebody and see what's going on or what? Yeah. But watching it today, and you know, I've seen things here and there, mm-hmm. but I just feel that right now that there could be a peak in wrestling like it was back in the day. I really hope so, because the boys need places to work.
Definitely.
But I really think that wrestling has changed. And what I mean by that, it's changed from the style. I mean, as far as the in-ring product and what guys are doing and not doing and stuff like that. And to me, the stuff that I've seen is that I think there's, you know, there isn't enough selling, and there isn't enough people really being the characters and really being a heel and a babyface, because wrestling is fucking easy. Mm-hmm. My analogy is that wrestling is like cowboys and Indians. You got good guys, you got bad guys. And that's pretty much what wrestling is. And if you want to do Circus Soleil and Flippity Doodah and all that other shit, that's great. That's good. You should go join a Vegas show. But when you're doing it in pro wrestling, what made pro wrestling so special and everything is that you had guys like the Steamboats and the Flairs and all that who told stories. There was the drama. There was the selling. There was all that stuff. And that stuff is missing today in today's professional wrestling. And I got involved when it was still, you know, kayfabe and all that other good stuff. I got in the tail end of the old school shit. Mm-hmm. So I'm an old school guy at heart. I'm not a grizzled old school guy, because there's a lot of them out there. But, you know, I just see it differently, you know. And that's what I look at it and I go, you know what? Like the Bumps and Bruises guys, Marty and Mikey, love those guys to death. You know, yeah. They'll ask me, hey, can you come out and help out? And, you know, hey, you want to get a match or whatever? And here's the beauty of where Marty Elias is right now in his life and his career. I can pick and choose pro wrestling and when I do it and how I do it and who I do it for. I don't need to go and fucking solicit myself or hold myself out to go, oh my God, book me for $25. Fuck you. I know my worth, you know?
Definitely.
So I don't need to go do that and beg for wrestling shit, because I don't need it.
Yeah.
I don't. And that's the advantage that I have, where other people who just do professional wrestling, they don't have that ability or flexibility to go pick and choose. And you know what? Again, my inspiration, my mentor, Chris Jericho, picks and chooses what he does and names his fucking prize.
Definitely.
You know? Hey. You know? And there's another influence in my life who's been a guy that I've known for over 30 years. His name is Dana Strum. And he was in Slaughter and he was in Vinnie Vincent. He lives in Vegas. And he manages Vince Neil. And I've known Dana for over 35 years. And talk about a guy who has been an inspiration as far as business and learning how to talk to people, learning how to come across intelligently and very well spoken. I mean, this guy has done amazing shit, you know, in my life. And you know, it's great, you know, and I love Dana to death. I mean, Jericho's another inspiration. Shawn Michaels is another inspiration. You know, there's a few guys out there that have really, you know, motivated me and inspired me that, you know, I don't need to do the pro wrestling thing. Wrestling was a platform, and it was what's the word I'm looking for? It was an avenue that got me to where I wanted to be, but there's so much more to Marty Elias and who I am that I just wasn't satisfied with that, because that's not who I am and that's not who I'm, how I'm wired. You know, I don't sit on my ass and wonder who's going to like me or who's going to book me and stuff. I go out and get shit done.
Damn. You know? That's
where I'm at.
That's pretty, mm-hmm. pretty amazing of a philosophy right there. I envy that for sure. So, yeah. So, Marty, what we're going to do next is we're starting to wind down the show just a little bit here, and
sure.
we're going to do some quick word association. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to name off a name for you. I just want for you to tell me the first thing that pops into your head when I say these names, and we're going to do this for 70 seconds. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's do it. Let's do it.
70 yep. deadly seconds starts now.
Vince McMahon.
Genius.
John Laurinaitis.
Asshole.
Undertaker.
The greatest.
Shawn Michaels.
The greatest number two.
Randy Orton.
One of a kind.
Hulk Hogan.
Icon.
Chris Jericho.
My friend and fucking mentor.
Charles Robinson.
A dear friend with nice blonde hair.
Mike Chioda.
A very good teacher.
Gene Simmons.
Greedy.
Paul Stanley.
Kiss.
Mark Slaughter.
A true friend.
And last but certainly not least, Vince Neil.
The boss.
Awesome.
He made it.
He made it. He survived. Made it.
Good job.
Got survived.
Yeah, Marty, you know, some people, man, they kind of freeze up when they start to hear that in the background. Like, oh, my God, I got to hurry up. And, you know, it gets a little...
No, that's what... Yeah, like, that's why I'm Marty Elias, and that's...
I know.
Why and
that's
I'm
why you're the fucking greatest.
Right.
Yeah, that's why I'm the fucking greatest. You know, I just, hey. Nothing phases me. Nothing phases me.
Hey guys, end with the schmoz. End with the schmoz. Go. Go, DJ, go.
End with the schmoz.
Right, right. Well, Marty, look, so tell us what events you got coming up, shows you got coming up that you want to promote so everyone can know about it.
Rockwise, got Vince Neil coming up September 28th and 29th out in Huntington Beach, California.
Okay.
We're actually going to be with Sammy Hagar's Beach Party out there. It's a two-day festival in Huntington Beach that Sammy Hagar started last year. So this is the second year that they're doing it. Vince Neil, Night Ranger, Tony Lewis of the Outfield.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Patti Smythe of Scandal who's going to be out there too. So it's going to be almost like a retro 80s vibe to it. It's a big beach party. Mm-hmm. Huntington Beach, come out, check that out. Tickets available at Ticketmaster. I mean, if you see me out there, you see my bro out there, come by and say hello and say, you know, what's up? And, you know, let's chat. Also got Slaughter that I'm doing at the Cannery off of Craig Road in Las Vegas. That's yes. October 22nd. Mm-hmm. So you guys are in town for that, love to have you come out and hang out with me and my bro Mike, and you know, we'll have a drink or two.
Yeah, awesome.
Most definitely
one of the greatest referees of all times. Everyone,
no impact. You got it wrong.
Okay, correct me.
The greatest referee
the greatest referee of all time, Marty Elias.
Absolutely. And you know what?
Yes.
I'll back that up and I'll tell you why. Because here's the thing. I was doing 0-1, AAA, PWG, all this stuff prior to going to WWE. I did it all on my own.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So, and then from after WWE, I went and I did Lucha Underground.
Mm-hmm.
I did rock and roll touring. I went, I did GLOW.
Yeah.
You know, I work on The Voice. I work on Songland. I work on these shows. So there isn't any other referee who fucking does that.
You know what? That's true.
You know, because I worked with all these promotions prior to WWE. And then after WWE, I didn't sit on my ass. I went and I was really heavily involved with Lucha Underground and did a lot there. And I'm a part of GLOW on Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I didn't go sit on my ass. You know, not many referees can say that.
That's true.
But I mean, look at my resume. I mean, look at my record. I mean, you know, my career, you're not too fucking shabby, you know, for a referee.
That's true. You will hold the title as the greatest. But now
absolutely, you know, nobody can fucking touch me.
What's up, everybody? This is your boy Simon Street with the Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting. I want to let everybody know that on Thursday, September 5th through Friday, September 6th at Sam's Town Hotel Gambling Casino, Impact Live Wrestling is going to be here in Vegas. Again, that's going to be on September 5th and September 6th at Sam's Town Live. We're going to be there. Hope to see you there too.
What's up, y'all? This is Sin City Steve. just urging you to join us, the Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting, as we are going to be at ROH, Death Before Dishonor, on September the 27th, live from Sam's Town here in Las Vegas, Nevada. Bell time is 6 p.m., and the very next night, September the 28th, there will be a live international TV taping. Again, September 27th and 28th, live at Sam's Town. Come check out Ring of Honor.
Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting.